So let me start by thanking all the organizers of this wonderful conference. I've learned a heck of a lot. So this is the title, and that's me. So the mainstay of this work is this person, Puyon Gayemi, a graduate student at MIT that has been wonderful for me to work with, really been played the lead role in this project. We've gotten a number of a good amount of very, very useful input from Piers Coleman at Rutgers. There's one paper that we've already written, and at least one of the papers are being prepared, and hopefully you'll be interested enough to look at it. To give some context for this work, let me start by talking about something that's not going to be the main concern of this talk, but it provides the context. So if you think about high-temperature superconductors in normal state, for many years now, many people have more or less agreed that one should think of it as a non-Fermi liquid metal. But there's one aspect of the physics of the cuprates that of this metal that is very intriguing, and it's I myself have wondered about it for a long time now, which is that there seem to be rather significant differences between different parts of a nominal Fermi surface that apparently is there in the normal state. And in particular, what's been noticed through several different probes is that the deviations from Fermi liquid behavior are most striking in some regions of the Fermi surface and less striking in some other regions of the Fermi surface. So in this so-called antinodal region near the zone boundary, the deviation from Fermi liquid physics is the strongest. And to the extent that there's any deviation, it weakens progressively as you go towards this diagonal nodal direction. So basically, what this is telling you is that not only are these materials non-Fermi liquids, but also the extent to which Fermi liquid theory doesn't work depends on where on the Fermi surface you are. Right? So there's all kinds of reasons to believe that statement, most parts of the cuprate phase diagram. So the cuprates are just one example of a strongly correlated metal. We have several other examples, heavy electron fluids, organics near the Mohr transition, and so on. So in many of these correlated metals, Fermi liquid theory, sometimes in many of them it fails, but not necessarily in all of them. The number of examples where Fermi liquid theory actually works. So a general question that one might be interested in is whether strong correlation physics can have very different effects and lead to anisotropy in momentum space, lead to different parts of the Fermi surface behaving very, very differently in a correlated metal, as we see happens in the cuprates. At an even broader level, the question perhaps is, what's the theoretical framework that will enable us to think about strong correlation physics and momentum space? Typically one tends to think about it in real space, it's local atomic level physics. But to marry that with the presence of a Fermi surface, what's a good theoretical framework? And there have been a number of interesting answers to questions of this sort on one-band Hubbard models and perhaps other systems through cluster DMFT by the usual suspects. So all kinds of interesting things have been found, but I myself am not intimately familiar with the DMFT techniques, so I won't comment on it much further. But if people are interested, they can take a look at this body of work. So in the cuprates, the issue seems to be that the extent to which Fermi liquid theory fails changes as you move along the Fermi surface. Now, of course, we don't have a framework for thinking about non-Fermi liquid physics. So in this work, what I'm going to talk about is a simpler question. Ask about a correlated Fermi liquid metal and ask about the extent to which Fermi liquid theory actually works as you go around the Fermi surface in a correlated metal. Right? So this question is obviously simpler because we have a framework for discussing Fermi liquid metals, so we can at least try to address that question. And the particular system I'm going to focus on are heavy Fermi liquid metals, again, precisely because it's a very well-developed theoretical framework to describe the system, even though it's a very strongly correlated metal. And the main punchline is going to be that from fairly simple and general theoretical considerations, it seems that there'll be a strong momentum dependence of the quasi-particle spectral weight as you go around the Fermi surface in this correlated metal. So the extent to which Fermi liquid theory works depends on where you are on the Fermi surface. Let me spend a few minutes very quickly reviewing some essential aspects of heavy electron metals. So basically, these are systems in which there's a weakly correlated conduction band coupled to a strongly correlated F band, 4F or 5F. They have large there's a Fermi surface with a large effective mass of the quasi-particles, and it's believed that that goes hand in hand with a small quasi-particle residue. So Fermi liquid theory is just barely well-defined. The quasi-particle residue is very small. And interestingly, in the strong correlation limit, the F band forms localized F moments, but at low temperature, these dissolve into the Fermi sea by Kondo's singlet formation, and the resulting Fermi surface is large in the sense that it counts the total number of both the moments, the localized moments, and the conduction electrons. So a useful framework to discuss the phenomenon of the heavy electron metal is this is an Anderson lattice model. You have some conduction electrons that hybridize with the F band, and there's a big U at the various F sites, and there's perhaps some bare F dispersion. Now the weak U limit is of course trivial to understand, and the C and F bands hybridize, and you get a Fermi liquid with a Fermi volume, which obviously includes both the C and F electrons. But this weak U limit is not physically relevant to a real heavy Fermi liquid because the effective mass is not large and the quasi-particle residue is basically of order 1. So the relevant limit is the strong correlation limit, where taking the simple example of a half-filled F band, each localized F orbital is singly occupied, so you get a lattice of localized F moments, the Kondo lattice, coupled to conduction electrons through something like this. So how are we going to treat the strong correlation limit? So a very useful theoretical framework is the slave particle formulation developed by various people in the mid-80s. I guess it was Andy Miller's PhD thesis. So the idea is to write the spin, represent the spin in terms of fermions, and again use the same notation F as I did earlier in the weak U limit, but with this constraint that the F occupancy at each site is restricted to be 1 exactly. So this constraint means that one really should not, in this formulation, in the Kondo lattice limit, one should not think of these Fs as electrons. They don't really couple to the external electromagnetic field. Rather, one should think of them as neutral spin-half fermions, sometimes known as spinons. So you can reformulate the Kondo lattice model in terms of these fermions and treat both the Kondo exchange and the constraint in mean field theory and end up with a mean field Hamiltonian that more or less looks like this weak U, the U equals zero Anderson Hamiltonian, but the interpretation is quite different. This hybridization between the C and F fermions is determined self-consistently, and this constraint of F single occupancy of the F site is also determined implemented self-consistently. So this leads to a band structure which, if the hybridization was zero, the F band would be completely flat, the C band would have some dispersion, and once there's some non-zero hybridization, this flat F band basically becomes this almost flat, but not exactly flat, lower band, which is partially occupied, and the Fermi level sits somewhere here, and that gives you a large Fermi surface and heavy quasi-particles and so on and so forth. So the momentum distribution within this kind of description looks like this. So below the original Fermi surface of the conduction electrons, it's mostly, again, it mostly just has C character, but then there's a very rapid crossover when you cross the original Fermi surface of the conduction electrons to what's mostly F character, and then there's a tiny jump at the true Fermi surface, which is the quasi-particle residue at the Fermi surface. So the interpretation of this hybridization amplitude, that really one should think about that as the amplitude for Kondo singlet formation, And this Kondo singlet delocalizes and gives you the heavy foamy liquid. And the heavy quasi-particles at the Fermi surface are mostly F-character, but they hybridize weakly with the conduction electrons. And right at the Fermi surface, the hybridization amplitude, the mixing, or the admixture of the C is of order this hybridization B, and B is small, so the quasi-particle weight at the Fermi surface is of order B squared, and that's basically of the same order as the inverse of the mass enhancement factor, which we know is very, very large in the heavy fermions. So Z, therefore, is very, very small. So that's the basic picture, that's the basic framework. Now, in thinking about real heavy Fermi liquids, there's one essential aspect of detail that seems to have very interesting effects. That's what I'm going to talk about. So, you know, clearly the local moment is in an F orbital, and let's say the conduction electron is in an S orbital, for simplicity. So then, this Kondo singlet that you form from the F moment and the conduction electron, the singlet molecule, clearly has non-trivial internal structure, that's non-trivial internal orbital angular momentum, just deriving from the symmetry of these two orbitals. So in real systems, this Kondo singlet molecule actually has non-trivial internal orbital structure. So this fact that this Kondo singlet has non-trivial internal structure, you can imagine, would lead to all kinds of interesting variations as you go around the Fermi surface in a heavy Fermi liquid. You can see that very simply if you take a toy model of a D-wave Kondo liquid, where each conduction, each local moment forms a D-wave singlet with a conduction electron. But in general, you know, it's a kind of thing that we know, that we're familiar with from, say, unconventional superconductivity or something. If the pairs that are condensing have non-trivial internal angular momentum structure, you start having the possibility of things like anisotropic superconductors and so on and so forth. So likewise, the same story you might expect here. And there have been similar theoretical discussions of gapless Kondo insulators previously by the people listed here. So let me illustrate this sort of thinking with a, again, highly simplified model for a cerium F1 ion, cerium-based heavy Fermi liquid with cerium in an F1 state, and let me assume a cubic environment. Now, if you had a single cerium ion, as because everyone in this room apparently knows, it's there are two spin orbit split levels, and the lower level is J equals 5 halves, and in the cubic crystal field, that splits into a lower doublet, Cramer's doublet, and a high-energy quadruplet. So let me take a simplified model where I focus on this lower doublet and write down a Kondo lattice type model describing the coupling of this doublet in a lattice to a band of conduction electrons. So, okay, so that's the usual conduction electron kinetic energy. And in the strong correlation limit, the F occupancy cannot change, so there's a constraint at each lattice site within this Cramer's doublet space. And there's some scattering of the conduction electrons of this doublet, which is described by some such term. And these matrix elements are simply the overlaps of various partial wave states centered at site R with the plane wave state of the conduction electron. So if one, you know, cranks through the mean field theory for this model, which captures the fact that the Kondo singlet has non-trivial orbital structure, then clearly the mean field hybridization is a matrix in the spin doublet space, and this matrix clearly has will in general have strong dependence on the direction of K. Right? So the hybridization amplitude, the hybridization matrix would have strong angle dependence, and for the particular case that I've been that I'm talking about, it actually vanishes along 100 and symmetrically related directions. So what you have in this sort of system are nodes in the hybridization function. Right? So the hybridization nodes. So this leads to all kinds of interesting things. So along the hybridization nodes, if you ask about the structure of the Fermi surface, so along the 100 direction, the large Fermi surface actually dips in and becomes part of the original small Fermi surface of the conduction electrons. So along all these points, near these points, large form itself is actually contained within the original small Fermi surface of the conduction electron. So along these hybridization node directions, the quasiparticles are essentially C-like, they're essentially conduction electron-like, but once you move away from these nodal directions, say towards the 111 direction, then they're basically like any other, like the simplified heavy fermion model, they become essentially F-like further away, which means that you basically end up with very strong angle dependence of how much C character you have for the quasiparticle once you incorporate this fact that the Kondo singlet has non-trivial internal structure. That's right, yeah. No, so there are other, I mean, so the quasiparticle residue also vary on the blue portions of the Fermi surface. That's right. It's not holes. I mean, it's right. Yeah. No. That's just dictated by symmetry. Right. Exactly. The symmetry that I have for the cerium, you know, Kamer's doublet. You know, in a cubic environment. So clearly, you know, if you change the symmetry of a crystal and so on, all those things are going to change. So I'm just looking at a very simple case. So the momentum distribution has, therefore, very, very different structure along different directions. If you look along, say, the 111 direction, looks pretty much like the picture I showed you before. It's mostly C out here, reasonably sharp crossover near the original small electron, small Fermi surface of the conduction electron, and then the small jump at the true large Fermi surface along the 100 direction, there's just this big jump and everything is basically C-like. So you might... No, along 100. No. This is the true Fermi surface. And that's what I'm calling KF large. Right? I mean, so this is the true Fermi momentum. I mean, this is what you would get if you measured the Fermi surface in De Haas-Van-Alphen or something. There's none of this. With the notation. Oh, I see. Yeah, you shouldn't take the absolute scale seriously. You know, there's an artist's rendering of the scale. Okay, let me just call this KF true. KF true, okay. So you could imagine probing this in photo emission, at least as a matter of principle. And so there's a small point of detail. If you start from the original Anderson lattice model, look at the extracted electron. You can either extract it in the Anderson model from the C band or off with the F band with some various matrix elements thrown in. But of course, in a strong correlation limit, changing the F occupation costs energy of order U. So naively, this term would not contribute at all. But just like one went from the Anderson model to the Kondo model, you have to do the V over U perturbation theory to get the correct electron operator. And it turns out there are two terms. A leading order of perturbation theory, a contribution to this electron operator, which actually contributes to the same order as the C term. So that's a detail. But so what you end up with is, apart from the ability to just kick out a C electron, you end up with a term of this sort at order V over U, which doesn't change the occupancy of the F site, but emits out a C conduction electron eventually. So in mean field theory, within the same mean field theory, this leads to an electron operator which has some such structure, but doesn't change the basic conclusion that along the nodal direction, the Z is of order 1, because the quasiparticles are C-like, but further away, the Z becomes of order the square of the hybridization, and therefore is very, very small. So the strong angle-dependent Z factor in this theory because of the fact that the Kondo singlet has non-trivial internal structure. So on the Fermi surface, so this is the internal, you know, the internal angular momentum giving you the k dependence. But think about dv, Cooper, yeah. Right. So it's condensed at zero momentum, if you wish. Yeah, that's right. The boson is internal structure. That's the main point. So the z is very, very anisotropic. It's a order 1 along these nodal directions, but it's a order 0, basically, everywhere else on the Fermi surface. So imagine you're actually doing a photo emission experiment. You know, if you don't have infinite resolution, then you might simply miss these small z portions of the Fermi surface and just end up with these discrete open Fermi surface patches in photo emission, which would be, you know, you might think that that's very, very weird. You know, it's the analog of Fermi aux or something of that sort. But of course, none of that is true. It's just that the z varies very, very strongly on the Fermi surface. So what about tunneling? So in the usual, you know, simplified Anderson model with just on-site interactions, the reduction of the z compensates for the increase in n star, and so the tunneling density of states is not enhanced. But sure, you can, since the z is distributed on the Fermi surface, you can worry about what happens to the mass. But it's very easy to see that the mass enhancement is also very, very strongly anisotropic, and along the nodal directions, there's more or less no mass enhancement. But along, let's say, the 111 direction, there's huge mass enhancement. So basically, the tunneling density of states is not enhanced within this kind of, even though both z and m star vary around the Fermi surface. So the remaining few minutes, let me talk about, at least try to think about similarity with cuprates. Right? Now, the cuprates, people have long been talking about these Fermi arcs in the pseudo-gap state. Very mysterious, all kinds of ideas are going around. So in light of what I've just told you in the heavy fermion system, certainly seems reasonable to imagine, to try and think about the possibility that this really is a large Fermi surface, but this is just varying very, very rapidly, being order 1 along this diagonal direction to becoming order 0 along these pi 0 directions. So could that be possible? Now, one immediately realizes that there's actually a problem. Making a direct analogy with the heavy fermions, the heavy fermions, as I just said, the small z regions actually have large effective mass. Now, that's certainly not what's going on in the cuprates. We know that the density of states measured, say, by spin susceptibility actually decreases on cooling into the pseudo-gap phase. So if you want your z to become small as you cool in, you certainly don't want that to be correlated with an increase of m star in the antinodal region as you go into the pseudo-gap phase. But in general, you know, z doesn't need to correlate with 1 over m star. It's true only if the self-energy has certain momentum independence for momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface. So one could still perhaps imagine that in the cuprates, what's going on, that there's a small antinodal z, but with no mass enhancement. Is that right? I don't know. But empirically, people say there's a gap along the antinodal region. So here, for instance, here's my question. So z is the weight of the peak. So if there is a quasi-particle peak, then z is the weight of that peak. Yeah. That's one way people measure it, yeah. So there's a tiny peak at the Fermi energy that, you know, you're not able to resolve. But in principle, you know, if you did a transport experiment, you would see, you know, transport coming from that part of the Fermi surface as well. Right. So, you know, just the photo emission doesn't rule out a large Fermi surface as such. So could the pseudo-gap phase actually have a large Fermi surface with strongly angle-dependent low-energy electron spectral weight? This seems to be a particularly crazy question to ask at this stage because the last few months been a lot of discussion, very interesting experiments on quantum oscillations in the underdoped cuprates in high fields, which clearly, apparently, which shows oscillation frequency is consistent with the small Fermi surface. But nevertheless, I think, you know, at least to me, it doesn't seem too crazy. And in particular, this consistency with the high-free quantum oscillations can happen at low temperature density wave transition for large Fermi surface of the kind that Dandy Millis and Mike Norman have recently proposed. One issue with that kind of proposal is that it seems as though what is required for that to work is for this 65 Tesla field to actually kill the pseudo gap. Which, okay, one may worry about whether that can actually happen. But if what you actually have is a large Fermi surface but with small z along those antinodal regions, then you're not actually killing the pseudo gap. You just don't, you know, and those regions can still continue to contribute to transport, but you just won't, you never see them in photo emission. So let me summarize. No. In this story, the density wave transition is just some folding of the large Fermi surface into some reduced Bilmo zone. Sorry? Okay. So let me summarize. So what I've argued is that in the heavy electron metals, the orbital structure of the Kondo singlet leads to a strong angle-dependent quasi-particle weight, and the angle dependency is correlated with the angle-dependent M star. So the heavy Fermi liquid is not uniformly heavy on the Fermi surface. So that's my last slide. Let me talk about a couple of things that I haven't quite emphasized, but I think are very interesting. This possibility of hybridization nodes in this heavy Fermi liquid seems to lead to all kinds of interesting physics. I've mostly talked about a Kondo lattice model, but if you think more generally about, say, a Kondo Heisenberg model, then this sort of this hybridization node seems to lead to a state which where the Z actually vanishes at isolated points on the Fermi surface. Now, I don't know what to call such a state. Is that a Fermi liquid? It's not smoothly connected to a non-interacting Fermi electron Hamiltonian of any kind. And right at this point with vanishing Z, you know, the gapless excitation is basically pure F with no mixing with the C. So, you know, it looks like you have gapless spin-ons at isolated points on a Fermi surface in what's otherwise a completely conventional phase. And second, if you think about heavy fermion superconductivity in a real heavy fermion system, that's driven by singlet bond formation between the local moments, driven by F pairing, sort of like RVB in ITC. You know, the F pairing structure can have whatever momentum dependence it does based on RKKY physics, but the pairing structure, the physical superconducting order parameter, clearly will inherit some extra momentum dependence coming from the momentum dependence of the hybridization. So there may be extra nodes, for instance, in the physical superconducting order parameter, which have nothing to do with the with any underlying nodes in the underlying pairing function of the local moments. And that's exactly right. Thanks.
The Coupe rates, where the true Fermi surface is, and where where the Z goes. Just pictorial.
Right. So, of course, no one knows where the true Fermi surface is.
No, I know
is,
within your this scenario. I mean, I don't.
No. So, what I'm wondering is, you know, just have an ordinary band structure Fermi surface, but the Z very, very strongly anisotropic, order one along the arcs, and order zero along the antinodes, but with no mass enhancement. And then at low temperature and high fields, this thing has a density wave transition. It folds into something else. You know, you can see pictures in the paper that, you know, Norman and Millis just wrote. And that can then be consistent with the quantum oscillations and Hall effect and so on that people have been measuring in high fields.
Where is the
No, this is in the high temperature state. The small temperature state is a density wave transition, so this thing will fold. You'll get pockets along here, for instance.
Maybe you could just tell me what the photo emission would look like as you go through the antinodal directions in this scenario.
Oh, in principle, if you imagine an ideal photo emission experiment, yeah, there'd be a tiny quasi-particle peak.
There'd be what?
There'd be a tiny quasi-particle peak at the Fermi energy with some non-zero weight, but the weight would be very, very small.
Okay, and then there would be, there must be something at lower energies then. No, I guess, okay.
Lower energies.
The spectral weight
going up somewhere else.
Yeah, no, at what
that's
scale?
The pseudo gap.
Okay, the spectral weight goes up at the pseudo gap scale.
That's it, yeah.
I see, but does that turn on? I see, and that can turn on a smeared way. Is that right?
That's high energy. That's 40 millivolts. Who knows?
Yeah. I have one comment and one question.
Okay.
So the comment is that I completely agree that anything with special structure has influence that factor is highly anisotropic. So, for example, this idea was exploited by Alexander Reynolds. They claim that that factor anisotropy due to the scattering from the shell of impurities.
From
the shell of impurities. It's also
impurities.
It's also object with the special structure.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is the following. So your theory relies on the two-component fermion liquid. One is a conduction electron with a small mass, and second is localized F-spins. So the question is, what stands for the localized F-spins in cuprates?
I don't know.
This is why the question is how this theory can be related to cuprates.
So the theory is, the actual, most of the talk is about heavy fermions, right? Now, once we understand this kind of thing in the heavy fermions, I'm just tempted to post this question in the cuprates, and hopefully, someone else will work out the theory. I don't know, I'm just joking.
I have a question. When discussing about Fermi surfaces of heavy fermion systems, I usually think about the work that Zwicknagel has done in the past, and I usually also similar work. Maybe can you tell us what conceptually you have done differently than Zwicknagel has done, in the 1990s?
Okay, I must confess, I don't know what Zwicknagel has done in the 1990s. So maybe you can tell me.
Oh, she's here. She's here, actually.
Yeah, she's here. Maybe she can comment on what the difference is, if there's any. Right. So I think, since I'm not aware of your work, I can't really comment on it seriously, but I want to make the following point. Band structure people, of course, I've known all along that, that there'd be anisotropies, blah, blah, blah. But the main thing I wanted to focus on was Z. And, so Z is obviously, something that comes out only, it's an interpretation of the band structure calculation, right? And that interpretation, the correct interpretation, the strong correlation. That's why this heavy fermion system is good, because more or less by doing band structure, you get something, some strong correlation effect, which is the reduction of Z. Mm-hmm. So you would, I'm happy to learn.
Going back to the model of heavy fermions, you used actually some symmetry properties of hybridization matrix element, which is quadratic part of Hamiltonian, right? Now I just simply wonder. It's known actually that
it's quadratic part of the mean field Hamiltonian. It's not quadratic for the original condo lattice Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but that's actually my question. It's known that actually the same effects as effective hybridization you can get from a real interaction by non-diagonal, F dagger C or whatever. There are many such terms in principle in the interactions, and some of them may imitate or may produce the same effects as hybridization, effectively. Now, would they follow the same symmetry rules, or they may be different for this type of terms?
Oh, I don't know.
Like, for instance, f dagger f, c dagger c, and I decouple it and obtain effective f dagger c times effective matrix element. Or there are, in general, in Coulomb interaction, there are also some non-diagonal terms which imitate hybridization, which contribute effectively to hybridization. Would they follow the same symmetry restrictions or not?
I mean, the structure of the hybridization term, you know, has to be consistent with cubic symmetry and so on, but beyond that, I'm not, I can't give you a more detailed answer.
Okay. That's a question I don't know.
Yeah.
Andy?
Yeah, first a quick comment and then a question. You might find it amusing to actually plot the shape of the Fermi surface for your model. I think you're going to find if you take, you know, a F electron interacting with jellium, that your points where a Z vanishes, you're going to get a Fermi surface which is basically like a balloon, which is deeply poked in at the points where the Z vanishes. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a big shift in positions associated with that, which might be interesting to look at.
Right.
Anyway.
So for various parameters, we have such plots, and they look exactly like what we're expecting. Cube rates, I'm just doing, you know, a phenomenological suggestion. You know. I don't understand your comment, but it's okay.
Here, may I actually ask my question, which is going either for the, in particular for the heavy fermion case, right? You wrote down a simple and appealing Hamiltonian, which had this hybridization, which vanished at particular points. To what extent is that protected by symmetry?
Oh, it's so long as I have cubic symmetry, it's completely protected. If I have some distortion, then it will go away.